Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The baby boomers have been big since birth, both as a population demographic and as a cultural force. And now their children, called echo boomers or millennials, are reaching young adulthood with all the confidence and high expectations they enjoyed growing up. But what about the 45 million Americans sandwiched in between, the ones born between 1960 and 1977? When does Generation X get its place in the sun? My guest today might argue that time is now, but that many of its most influential members are just as happy to keep on working and leave both the dreamy optimism and the spotlight to those who seem to need them more. Jeff Gordonier is editor-at-large of Details magazine. His new book is called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft, but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. That was so brilliantly put that I don't know how to follow it up.
Well, thanks for that.
Can I quote you on all that?
Absolutely.
Terrific.
I'll email it to you. So to what extent, Jeff, is what we believe determined by when we were born?
Well, that's a great question. One thing I'm discovering with this book, X Saves the World, is that Xers do respond to it instantaneously. I've had a lot of people tell me, I read it in 2 days, I read it in 3 days, I was reading passages out loud, and I'm learning that demography is destiny to some degree. You know, like, if you grew up in certain years, you marinated in the same media as everyone else. You know what I mean? Like, you watch the same TV shows, the same reruns, listen to the same music, maybe the same political events. These things inform our perspective and, you know, create a different sensibility. I think Xers have a pretty radically different sensibility than the boomers who preceded them, just as the boomers had a radically different sensibility than the greatest generation that won World War II. So, you know, people will say, well, you're generalizing. But in fact, you know, when you get in conversation with someone, you know, who's from your general age range, it's remarkable how many traits and habits and inclinations you share.
You talk about Willy Wonka in the book. It came out in 1971, but it was on TV all the time when I was a kid, and I guess when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And it was this huge influence on our overall values. What did we learn from that movie?
Well, I watched that movie countless times, and it's funny to watch it now because Gene Wilder, for one thing, is so sarcastic. You know, you think Willy Wonka is just going to be this happy, you know, candy maker, but actually he's incredibly ironic and nervy. And
he's sort of evil. Yeah.
He's actually sort of a progenitor to you know, Stephen Colbert, if you think about it. And I think he influenced us in that way. But really the influential moral lessons of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory come from the fact, you know, there's these kids chosen for this publicity stunt at the Chocolate Factory. And they get to tour the factory, and somebody will get, you know, a special prize at the end. And basically, each kid is peeled off when they do something terrible in the factory. Maybe they, you know, Augustus Gloop tries to drink from the chocolate river. Another kid tries to steal the everlasting gobstopper. And what happens to these kids? They're punished. They're punished for their greed. They're punished for their, you know, they're wanting to be on TV so desperately. So I think Xers, like, you know, we internalize these lessons that, you know, if you crave the limelight too much or you're too greedy, you know, the cosmos or at least Willy Wonka, we're going to punish you. So this informs how we look at these millennials coming up, because whether they like it or not, whether they want to admit it or not, Paris Hilton is their hero.
So they're unabashed Wonka kids.
Yeah, they're like the kids who would have been punished. They desperately want to be on TV. They want money. They love advertising. They love consumerism. They love to go to the mall. Yeah. You know, they seem to be rewarded for all the things that the Wonka kids were punished for.
Well, the funny thing about that movie is I as a kid, used to fall asleep every time I watched it before the very end when you realize they didn't die these tragic deaths. They were just sort of taken away for a while.
And you were scarred.
I thought they were just gone forever, and I guess that maybe the messages really got in.
That's
but,
great.
So Generation Y, or the millennials, whatever you want to call it, are they being over-parented, or were we under-parented?
Well, I think they're being overparented. I mean, these are the classic, you know, the children of the boomers who are overscheduled and their parents did their homework for them, you know, and they're coddled. And you see this in the office, you know, when you have an intern in the office who's calling his parents to get advice every 5 minutes. I mean, you know, but you know, I got to be honest. I'm gonna go easier on the millennials. I was pretty hard on them in the book, and I'm thinking of of being nicer, because I've noticed that the readings, a lot of millennials are showing up.
So, you need interns too at the magazine, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I changed my mind. They're great. Please come to the readings. But you know, I think that they were, you know, like, if you're an Xer, you might actually remember footage from Vietnam. I mean, that's like the first war I remember, you know, hearing about. For better or worse, my father had the television on all the time, and I remember hearing about this war. And the first president I remember is Richard Nixon. I remember him resigning. So, you know, okay, that's going to, if we're talking about Xers being sort of sarcastic and skeptical, that might have something to do with it, right? And then, on the other hand, these millennials, for a lot of them, the first president they remember is Ronald Reagan. And they remember a completely different national mood. So, again, I mean, I think these forces, you know, in the national conversation, sort of help determine, you know, how each generation is. But I'm befuddled by them. I mean, you know, what's weird is that, you know, for a lot of Gen Xers, I mean, the term alternative, you know, has become, unfortunately, this overused marketing term. But if you take the scare quotes off of the word alternative, that's what a lot of Xers are drawn to. We're drawn to stuff on the fringes, whether it was indie rock, you know, sort of, you know, outlaw authors, indie filmmakers, you know, and I think to some degree we're interested in the art created by these people. You know, I mean, a lot of Xers I know actually are film buffs and music fans. And what I got to admit, it confuses me about the millennials coming up is they just seem interested in celebrity itself, right? Celebrity per se, Paris Hilton as simply a star representing nothing. I mean, she doesn't sort of do anything. You know, so there's always, so now we can become cranky and Andy Rooney-ish about this. You know what I mean? Like each generation vexes the one that came before, and they seem to be vexing us by being so mass, being unapologetically mass and enthusiastic. They're like an army of cheerleaders or mall rats.
Jeff Gordon-Ayer is my guest. He's editor-at-large of Details Magazine. His new book is called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. I saw a blog written about the generation, I guess it's gap or issue, by someone who was much younger. She's a millennial, and she said, "We know that the Gen Xers can't stand that we are the rainbow in their endless rainstorm." And there really is, as you referred to, you know, they're much, much happier to accept things. What is this sort of pall of cynicism that came over a generation that, although we might remember Vietnam and we might remember Watergate, essentially we were that one in the middle that didn't have a terrifying incident to grow up with?
That's true. And, I mean, there's something sort of Marsha about the way we whine about it. You know what I mean? I admit. I don't know. You know, in a way, if I were to be really sappy and Oprah about it, I suppose that the millennials could learn from us and we could learn from them. Like, it'd probably be nice if the Xers were a little more upbeat. My parents are always telling me, be a little more upbeat, be a little more outgoing. And it'd probably be good if the millennials were a tad more skeptical. You know what's a good example is the Barack Obama campaign. Okay, first of all, what's interesting is everybody claims Barack Obama. That's part of the genius of his candidacy. You know, the boomers say he's a late phase boomer. The Xers say he's an early phase Xer. I certainly would argue that. And then the millennials say, no, he's our kindred spirit. He's one of us. But the thing is, I don't know if you've been to one of the Obama rallies, when you see the millennial kids with, you know, chanting and just sort of swooning, just in love with Barack Obama. I mean, it seems like this kind of blind romantic faith that, you know, as an Xer, I feel like, well, dude, you're going to be burned. You know, are you aware of that? it's not going to work out. I mean, like, he's a great guy, he's a cool guy, whatever. But you know, he is a politician. Anyone running is a politician, and that carries certain, you know, certain meaning.
Well, I remember growing up in the 80s, and my parents are baby boomers. They were some of the very first. They were not hippies or anything. But I remember thinking how lucky people were who were, you know, teenagers and in their 20s in the 60s, because what an amazing time that was. And now...
Yeah, but the 80s were fun, too.
They were great. But I mean, we were told over and over about how the boomers had done everything. And there was a certain amount of envy as to... It seemed to us, you know, 20 years later, that it must have been this extraordinary time where everybody was all about peace and love. And I wonder if somehow the millennials just accept that's possible, and they just create it for themselves.
Yeah, that could be it. I mean, they grew up with they grew up hearing that from their parents, a lot of them, you know, about this great time. And I don't know, but all that talk about the great times the boomers had, I feel like I've always felt like sort of Keanu Reeves in The Matrix with those those feeding tubes attached to him when he's in the gelatinous tub. Mm-hmm. Like this stuff is just poured into our brains. Woodstock, 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 Summer of Love, Summer of Love, Summer of Love, Summer of Love. And we're just supposed to be like, ah, yes, those were the good times.
You can make fun, but you went to Woodstock, too. Were you trying to recapture
that? I went to Woodstock,
that?
Too. But, like, you know, like, read Joan Didion's, you know, Slouching Towards Bethlehem. You see what the hippie life was really like. I mean, it was dark. It was grotty. You know, I mean, like, you know, Woodstock, whatever, it was just a party. I mean, it didn't change the world in any way. I'm glad those folks had fun. I'm glad they were swimming naked, and, you know, I would have liked that, too. But the idea that somehow Woodstock changed the world, it really just created a nice tourism business for upstate New York, you know. But, you know, like, I went to Woodstock 94. I was working at Entertainment Weekly at the time. A lot of the book draws on stuff I've done over the years. Because I worked at Entertainment Weekly, I was on a set of various films and interviewed various musicians, and I actually was one of those weird Gen X expatriates in Prague, really honestly, only for a couple of months, but I got a glimpse of it. And Woodstock 2 was just, it was just absurd. It really was, because it was like the guys who owned the Woodstock brand were gonna teach us now, man. We're gonna teach you about peace and love, because it's time you guys bellied up to the bar. It's time you get with the program. But peace and love at that point had just become a brand, you know, like Pepsi. I mean, or like Apple. It was just it didn't mean anything. It was just something that would sell, you know, necklaces. You know, it was just something to sell T-shirts, really. I mean, there was no actual peace or love discussed.
Well, it's funny, through the book, and certainly your career has been a lot in the media and in analyzing media and different entertainment media. What strikes me as interesting, because it's all sort of filtered through popular culture and the things that we all consumed as a generation, the cultural contributions of Generation X are technologies that allow users to create the content as opposed to being the content itself.
That's right.
So in other words, we didn't create the Beatles. We didn't throw them up there, but we have, you know, Napster and iTunes and YouTube.
Absolutely. You know, there are certain aspects of boomer ideology that the boomers never really lived up to. They never really delivered. And strangely, without trying to, the Xers have. I'll give you two examples. One is YouTube. YouTube, I think, is as important as the Library of Congress. and I'll tell you why. When I was researching this book, you know, I procrastinated. I'm not the first author to slack and waste time staring out the window. So I would go on YouTube and I would call up funny videos that friends had sent me when I should have been writing. And, you know, I came upon this video of Iggy Pop, right, doing Fun Time with David Bowie on keyboards on the Dinah Shore show in the 70s.
Wow.
Okay, this will change your life. I'm not sure if it's still up on YouTube, but it floored me. It was so awesome. And then I found a clip of Captain Beefheart in 1972 on a German TV show. And I started to find all this stuff. I found a group of senior citizens singing in unison, a cappella, Schizophrenia by Sonic Youth. And I thought, this is where it's alive. This is alternative culture now. It's in this library called YouTube, and it's available to anyone for free. So, okay, you can't find it on MTV anymore, but you can find it here, right? And so that sort of freak power thing that the hippies talked about, actually, the YouTube guys brought it about.
Jeff Gordonier is my guest. He's editor-at-large of Details Magazine. His new book is called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. Our conversation continues after the break. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is the author of a book called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. His name is Jeff Gordonier. He's editor-at-large of Details Magazine. If you'd like to join us, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. I want to go back for a second, Jeff, to the whole YouTube phenomenon. You talk about the culture really being alive there and people come together. What's odd about it, though, is that it's not sustained. In other words, my kids found a video this weekend of Harry Potter and some puppets, and I looked at it, and something like 370,000 people had viewed this thing, which is pretty extraordinary. But it struck me that kids will watch it once or twice, and then it's over. They may not remember it. Whereas anybody in our age group, if you say, pretty sneaky, sis, you expect to hear the Connect Four checkers fall. And there are some shared references that I think the current generations are not going to have. And I wonder how that will continue to keep us divided according to generation.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I think there are certain YouTube videos that at a certain point may actually be profound and will leave some sort of imprint on American culture. I don't know that that's happened yet. I don't know that YouTube has had its Smells Like Teen Spirit moment yet. Although there was that Lazy Sunday video where the two guys from Saturday Night Live.
Oh, the cupcakes and
Andy Samberg and Chris Parnell rapping about cupcakes. I mean, that was pretty amazing. I mean, that actually has some sort of generational resonance. It was just hilarious. So, I mean, I don't know that for something to leave a mark on the culture, it has to be 90 minutes long and shown in a theater. I mean, that paradigm is just changing. You know, and the sort of the democratic impulse of YouTube, the fact that anybody can put something up, and anybody can watch it and it's free is as I was saying, it's sort of linked to that hippie ethos that vanished. I mean, I put something up on YouTube for my book. My friend Russ Spencer put something up of me talking about the book, and it's terrific. It's like actually been really useful. Another technological advancement company that I think embodies this idea of Xers doing something the hippies couldn't pull off is meetup.com. Okay, I spoke with Scott Heiferman, who's one of the founders of meetup.com for my book. And look, the hippies talked about, the boomers talked about, let's bring people together. Well, what does meetup.com do? It actually makes that happen. If you have an interest in Barack Obama, if you have an interest in chocolate, if you have an interest in poodles, if you have an interest in Sonic Youth, whatever your interest, all over the world, you can go on Meetup, type in your zip code, this is your community, and you'll find like-minded people. And then you meet with them in the real world. It's not just this detached thing where you converse via email. You'll find a local coffee house and meet and share your enthusiasm for that. I mean, that's incredibly empowering. You know, obviously, Meetup got a lot of attention during the Howard Dean campaign back in 2004, but it's much richer. It's a much richer experience than that. When I interviewed Scott Heiferman, it was funny because I asked him, he's a classic Xer, I asked him, do you believe in changing the world? And he was like, oh, God, please don't say that. Don't use that phrasing. It makes me ill. And he said that when they were doing the mission statement for Meetup.com, certain founders of the company wanted to put, our goal is to change the world into the mission statement, and the other ones fought back against it. it was perceived as too cheesy, even though, strangely, that's what the site does.
It's the sort of overthinking, I think, that also defines our generation.
Yeah, we're incredibly argumentative. I mean, in a strange sense, to be honest, it's an obstacle I find with the book. Because people are like, whatever, Gen X. And then they read it, and they seem to enjoy it, and they laugh, and they're like psyched that they were a part of it. But yeah, we're just contentious, and I think that we're resistant to the idea of a we anyway. It's like the boomers seem to be all about the we, the collective. Like we marched in the streets, man. We went to Woodstock, and the millennials too are almost like this teeming hive. Like they seem to all agree, and they agree that they agree, and they agree that they all want to do the same thing.
Sometimes that sounds nice.
They're a lot more ornery than that. You know what I mean? like you can mention a band that you presume all Xers like the Pixies, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll just get in a fight. I mean, I won't. I love the Pixies, but you mention them, and I never really liked them, you know.
But do you remember a period? You're 41 now.
I am.
Okay. Do you remember the moment when it didn't matter so much anymore if you were cool by traditional definitions? Or you work for detail, so maybe it still matters, but.
No, I'm not cool. I'm a suburban dad. I've never been cool. I mean, I don't know. I sort of gave up on that a long time ago. I mean, I think the moment you know you're not cool is when you can feel it from MTV. I mean, those folks at MTV, they're savvy. You know, they have their scientists working, you know, on market research, and they know when you're obsolete. And you can feel it. You're watching MTV, and you're like, hey, wait, where did the buzz bin go? What's this TRL thing? What's this Britney Spears stuff? This is just
where's Martha Quinn? Yeah,
you know, and like yeah, where did Weezer go? Now we have the Backstreet Boys. What happened? You know, and what they're saying, MTV is sending you a message. They're saying move on. You know,
to
go
VH1.
To C-SPAN now. It's time. You know, it's time to retire. And you can feel that they don't love you. You know. And this changed with the real world. You know, the real world is just about to have its 20th season, and I just wrote an essay for details about the impact of the real world, which I think is seismic on American culture. And, you know, in like the third season was in San Francisco with this Miltonian conflict between Puck and Pedro. You know, Pedro had AIDS. Puck was this villain of the house. That episode brought up a lot of important issues in this country, you know, and raised awareness and visibility for AIDS and things like that. Eventually, the real world, for better or worse, just degenerated into the hot tub, you know, like hookups in the hot tub. And when you would watch it, you're like, I don't think this show's for me anymore, you know?
Well, I wonder even, you know, you talk about the real world. It's so many times when people talk about Gen X and its heyday, it's all about plaid flannel and slackers and coffee and Kurt Cobain, 1991.
Yeah. 91, yes.
And I'm wondering if, you know, we're beyond all that now. We've got kids and jobs and mortgages, but
sure.
But maybe we peaked as a cultural force before we were ripe.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely peaked then, and we weren't even ready for it. I mean, I got to admit, I never understood the flannel thing. I'm not a lumberjack, you know. I'm like an old preppy. And, I mean, I do have flannel pajamas, I guess. But, I mean, a lot of those things were just, you know, sort of media buzzwords that were cut and pasted around, but we did sort of own the early 90s, and we didn't realize it at the time. We didn't really maximize our impact, but I remember 91 vividly. I mean, I was unemployed. I was slacking. Now, this word slacker is stuck to us like a barnacle on the hull of a ship. It's just, you know, there, you're slackers. I mean, I'm 41 years old. I got two kids. I work, you know. I'm not, that doesn't even make any sense anymore. We invented Google. Come on. But on the other hand, there was a time when I was just kind of hanging out in coffee houses, I admit it, and drinking beer in Prague. And when, you know, that year is when Slacker came out, the Richard Linklater film, a great, great Texan, and Nirvana broke through with Nevermind and completely obliterated the world of pop music. I mean, it was just turned everything on its ear. And Doug Copeland published this novel, Generation X, which nailed it, which sort of finally gave voice to this weird dark horse demographic that hadn't really been spoken for. Now, I remember getting that book. I went to a bookstore, I heard about it, and I went and got the book, and I thought it was hilarious. I still think it holds up, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's what I am.
I have a McDonald's.
It was like coming out of the closet. It was like, oh, I didn't know what I was. I'm a Generation Xer. I, you know, a lot of people don't like the term or whatever. Who cares? I mean, we're not going to get rid of the term at this point. It's too late for a brand relaunch. But I think he just captured it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Jeff Gordonier. He's editor-at-large of Details Magazine. His new book is called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hey, John.
Hey, Chris and Jeff.
Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm doing great. And you've made me think a lot here. I'm 47.
Cool.
And I wasn't obviously part of the greatest generation. I was the tail end of the baby boom, but it had nothing to do with the 60s, you know.
Right.
My first real memories are, you know, Marshall Brady and Gilligan and all that.
You're one of us.
Yeah, well, but I'm born in 60, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But here's the deal. It's like back in the old days, and I guess back in the 60s and 70s, there's a big, quote, generation gap.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the beauty of the Gen Xers and the Gen Yers, and my kids are Gen Yers, they're anywhere from 15 to 20.
Uh-huh.
there is no generation gap that I feel with them. They have caught up with the technologies and whatever, how they're living. I feel part of their generation now. I text them. I'm on YouTube with them.
Mm-hmm.
They've brought me back, or they've got me up to speed, or kept me up to speed. And so we don't really feel any generation gap in our family. Obviously, there's an age gap and a personality gap, but those antagonisms that maybe other generations have felt towards each other, I think, have been liquidated, whether it's by the technology, the entertainment, maybe just how we were shaped by our parents that we weren't going to do that with our kids. But I'd like you to comment on that.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's a great point. You know, I think, and it actually leads to an idea for a movement, maybe that the millennials and Gen Xers should finally band together as comrades and overtake the boomers for once and for all. But I think that you make an interesting point, which is that, you know, there are these, the way media works now is that we all share these experiences. I was at a reading, and after the reading, I was just randomly quoting some lines from a song by that band Pavement, a sort of, you know, Gen X identified band from the 90s. And a couple of people that attended the reading who were in their early 20s started singing the lyrics too. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, these differences are not always as sharp as we think. They share that experience, and in a way I felt sort of a kinship with them. But I will say, well, I'm going to say three words that convey the existence of a generation gap. High School Musical.
My kid would love that movie.
See, I mean, that to me that is the horror, you know?
It's a Disney movie, and it's a musical with stripped of, it's got romance, but there's absolutely no sexuality or anything remotely objectionable.
It's almost absolutely nothing. I don't even understand what it is. It's almost like mannequins moving around and singing dippy songs.
In lip gloss.
Yeah, exactly. Like all glossy. Now, see, that's where I don't, when we talk about this drop-off of alternative culture, that's where you see it. Look, here's the thing. Like, we've always associated rock and roll with rebellion in this country, you know? So the different waves of rock and roll would signify your generational rebellion. For me, it was like punk rock, you know, and indie rock and stuff. But this generation coming up, the one that identifies with things like High School Musical, I mean, they seem to, their rebellion is the opposite.
But
it's like, just like to go Disney, you know, like Hannah Montana, and that's really weird.
I think maybe, though, if you think about it, we had, you know, there were the boomers who were very idealistic, and they may not have done everything they set out to do, but they talked about it and believed in it. We, you know, sort of rebelled against that by being very sarcastic and very suspicious of certain things. Maybe, you know, it's like a ping pong ball. Maybe this next generation is responding to our irony by creating something that's very positive.
I think that's brilliantly put. I think that's exactly it. I think that's their form of rebellion, is to say, oh, you're a bunch of grumps. You know, you're a bunch of Oscar the Grouch guys. You know, like, quit whining. You know, we're just having a party. We're going to have fun. You know, it's the 50s again. You know, I must say I was cheered by my daughter Margot, who is 5. We went to a birthday party, and somebody put on High School Musical, which I gotta say I'm fuddy-duddy enough to think it's not quite appropriate for 5-year-olds. But nevertheless, it was on, and then we were in the car, and I said, Margot, what do you think of that? And she's like, it was dumb. I love you, honey. What a good girl. It was dumb, wasn't it? It was so silly. She's like, it was really silly. I was like, yeah, it's silly. Let's go back to that Fellini Film Festival we were having, you know?
The Bicycle Thief is playing right now.
Yeah, exactly. Remember La Dolce Vita? Now, that's a movie. No, I mean, you know, it's great that there's wave after wave of this stuff, but, like, I guess that form of rebellion I find, well, I guess there's a camp aspect to it, but I find it bizarre.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey, I'm 40 years old, absolutely a typical Gen Xer. In fact, I would say I was absolutely, you know, a slacker.
Nice.
when I was growing up. And I kind of noticed that when I was growing up much younger, you know, in the 80s, it was definitely the age of excess. You know, you work your butt off, you have a whole bunch of stuff to show for it. Then we came along, we didn't do anything, but we also didn't expect anything either. We just kind of existed. And it may be just me sitting now what I feel like is an old grandpa on the front porch on my you know, rocking chair saying, these kids. But at the same time, what I feel like is happening today is that there is a generation that doesn't do anything, but yet they expect a lot.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like this weird melding between the 80s and the 90s, and you were talking about that earlier, about what has come of all of this. And I wonder if you kind of share the same thing, or if you see like maybe a connection that, that exists between the two of those.
That's an interesting point, Tim. I mean, you know, one thing I hear over and over in reaction to this book is the word entitlement. You know, people really feel that the millennials coming up have a sense of crazy entitlement about what they deserve, what they should get, and when they should get it, which is 5 minutes from now. You know, you see it in the workplace, you see it in offices. I'll tell you a funny story. A friend of mine who works in media in New York had an assistant. He promoted the assistant to a sort of associate level. And after a couple of months, the associate came to him and said, I want a promotion. And then he slid something across the desk. And what he slid across the desk was a 20-page memo, right, called How to Manage Me. And, you know, my friend, who's 41, has kids and stuff, was just flabbergasted. He's like, I mean, the solipsism of that, the idea that the entitlement, the idea that, like, all Chris has to worry about, my friend, is this kid and, you know, managing him. I don't know. We're generalizing, but it's something that I hear over and over, and I think it's starting to bum people out. You know, it's grating. But here's the thing: is like, you know, the slacker terminology. There was a reason that came about, and I remember the date it started. It was October 19th, 1987. There was a stock market crash. I graduated from college in 1988. Good timing. I got out of college. I couldn't find work at a newspaper. There weren't any jobs. You know, I kept hearing about hiring freezes and cutbacks and, you know, could you do freelance work? So that's why I was hanging out in coffee houses.
Not that you didn't want to work, you just couldn't.
No, I wanted to work. I was, you know, just nothing, no place to go.
Jeff Gordonier is with us. He's editor-at-large for Details Magazine. His new book is called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. We'll take more of your calls and emails after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jeff Gordonier. He is editor-at-large of Details Magazine, and his new book is called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. I want to talk for a minute about where you think we're going from here. There's a great section in the book where you quote somebody as saying that at 37, the Sheraton enzyme kicks in, which makes it hard to sleep on someone else's couch anymore when you're out of town. And then you write that soon that mutates into the Four Seasons endorphin.
That's right.
Which I can completely relate to. Are we somehow gentrifying and are we going to become the boomers despite ourselves?
Everybody gentrifies. Let's face it. Everybody is vulnerable to personal gentrification. For me, the gateway drug was olive oil. You know, I'm not a yuppie about clothes. I'm not a yuppie about cars, but I am an incorrigible yuppie when it comes to food. I had lunch yesterday with another writer, and it seemed like all we talked about was duck confit and polenta. And, you know, hey, look, you get older, you like nice stuff. You don't want to sleep on people's floors. I happen to think that the Gen X manifestation of yuppieism is a little different. Doesn't make it any more right, but it's a little different. I mean, I tend to think in the same way we're drawn to indie music and indie film, we're drawn to things that are micro-brewed and small-batched and farm-raised and obviously organic. And in some ways, this has a good impact on our culture and how we consume food and things like that. I mean, when you talk about where we're going, part of the reason I wrote the book was not just to sort of play off this generational friction, which is fun, but to validate the place of Gen X in American culture, to acknowledge the things we've accomplished. And, you know, I think that we've accomplished a lot more than people think. I mean, start with these tech companies, Google, Yahoo, Wikipedia, Amazon.com, YouTube, MySpace. Those are all invented by Gen Xers. They've changed the course of global business. They've changed the way we consume media. They've changed the way we find each other. They've changed what we watch. You know, that's pretty big. and then in the arts, you think of like Being John Malkovich and Lost in Translation, which I think is an exquisite movie. Boogie Nights, There Will Be Blood. These are films made by Gen Xers. You think of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who are American heroes in my mind. I mean, they've changed the way we look at the democratic process.
But they're the first to say they're not trying to do that.
I know. Of course they have to say that. Of course they have to say that. I mean, they can't say they're activists or subversives or anything like that. And they're not. They're comedians. And yet they're truth tellers, too, whether they like it or not. Their mode of comedy happens to hinge on truth telling. And, I think that during some complicated years, shall we say, the last 8 years, they have given us the gift of sanity. And there are a lot of people for the book that are more obscure whom I sought out and talked to. Majora Carter, who runs an organization called Sustainable South Bronx here in New York, and her slogan is Greening the Ghetto. It's a guy named Cameron Sinclair, who runs Architecture for Humanity. A guy named Fritz Haig, who's behind the Edible Estates movement and started in California, now it's going global, which is encouraging people to put gardens in their front lawns instead of grass. These are classically ex-activists and philanthropists. They're doing it to some degree under the radar, and they're often doing it on a local level, acting locally and sending out shockwaves in their communities, trying to improve their communities, at the ground level. Cameron Sinclair said a fascinating thing to me when I had I had breakfast with him when I was researching the book. He's the guy from Architecture for Humanity. And I said, Cameron, what's the difference, between your approach, the sort of Gen X approach to, improving the planet and the boomer approach? And he said, put it simply, the boomers believed in utopia and I don't. He doesn't believe in perfecting the planet. You can't. There will always be problems. You just solve the problems you can solve. You do what you can at the local level, or in his case, at the global level, to fix what you can at the moment, and then new problems come. The boomers seem to have this Woodstocky, misty rapture about this idea that they were going to sort of perfect the world and create a utopia. And there's nothing worse than dashed innocence. I mean, when they lost that dream, they seemed to just capitulate to brie, cheese. They just seemed to say, oh, well, forget it. We'll just become Gordon Gekko.
But you brought this up. I mean, a lot of the accomplishments of Gen X have to have grown out of the ground that was laid by the boomers.
Well, sure. But, I mean, every accomplishment grows out of, what was laid before. I mean, some people have pointed out to me, well, there are people like Bill Joy and Tim Berners-Lee created the programming that would lead to something like Google. Well, sure. I mean, somebody built the road, that Jeff Gordon drives on. You know what I mean? Like, it's like there's always, sure. I mean, people did the programming before, but that's just a way of taking credit away from Xers. I mean, I don't want to be grumpy about it, but it really is true. I mean, Google is probably the most important company in the world right now in terms of defining the human sensibility. I mean, it's rewiring our brains.
Jeff,
can you imagine life without Google?
No, I don't know how I would do my job without Google, honestly.
Exactly.
Jeff Gordonier is my guest. His book is called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. Let's speak next to Matt in Fort Worth. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to ask, do you think that the definition of Generation X, as you define it, describes largely the behavior of young white Americans born during that time, or do you think it can be equally sort of transposed or applied to other ethnic groups during the same time? In other words, are they equally represented in this kind of profile and behavior, or is it largely a cultural phenomenon of young white Americans born during that period?
That's a brilliant question. I think that a lot of the demographic work that's done does tend to apply to sort of middle-class white Americans. You're absolutely right. I do think, though, that if you look at, like, since I talk about pop culture in the book a lot, talk about bands like Nirvana and singer-songwriters like Liz Phair, you know, I also talk about Lauryn Hill. And, you know, I think that if you look at, you know, the impact of Gen X musicians and hip-hop, you know, for instance, Lauryn Hill, Jay-Z, A Tribe Called Quest, Common, you see a shared sensibility. It's interesting. I mean, you see a similar emphasis on a certain kind of quality, a certain essence in terms of how the music's delivered, a certain integrity that I think is you know, in keeping with the Gen X ethos. So, I mean, I tried as much as I can to make sure the book had diversity in that respect, and I think that's a really good question.
What about, is it possible, maybe you're not even striving for this, is it possible to have any objectivity about one's own generation?
That's a good question. Well, I did have objectivity. You know, the weird thing is I was totally negative about it when I started. Like, this all started with an essay I did for Details Magazine 2 years ago exactly. It came out in April 06. And that was just this greed that poured out in a couple of days. And it was really, the thesis of that was like, it's over, man. We've accomplished nothing. We're crushed. Let's just call it a day. Let's go to, you know, move down to Boca now. you know, so that, the book came out of that. I got a book deal out of that. And as I started researching the book, I did a 180. You know, like, so I actually was sort of objective about it. I started talking to these people, like I mentioned, you know, Scott Heiferman and Majora Carter and Cameron Sinclair and Fritz Haig, and they turned my head around. I realized they were doing fascinating stuff, and I started just, you know, doing research, just looking at all these companies that Gen Xers had started that, unfortunately, I didn't start. I sure wish I'd started Google and had some of that stock. But nevertheless, you know, I'm part of it generationally, I guess. And you know, I really believe in the thesis of the book. I think that Gen Xers are actually keeping a lot of great stuff in the American spirit alive, whether it's an entrepreneurial spirit, whether it's an alternative viewpoint. I mean, here's the thing. Like, a lot of it, in a way, was spurred by American Idol. Now, I don't get American Idol. I know I'm alone in that.
No, it's horrible.
I know everyone loves it, but, I mean, to me, it's just Star Search, you know? And I understand its appeal as mass entertainment. My problem with it is the media monotony about it. My problem is this kind of monocultural idea that we're all talking about American Idol. Are we not? We are talking about American Idol now because we are, you know, it's like living under the Kremlin. We all talk about American Idol. We love it. We love it. You know, I think our country is more interesting than that. You know, when we talk about diversity and stuff, I mean, thousands of opinions, thousands of musicians out there. And I also think American Idol consolidates a phony idea of what artistry is about. You know, there are great American artists like Patti Smith, you know, Lauryn Hill, Liz Phair, Amy Mann, who, you know, are not perfect singers or perfect, you know, they're not just, you know, doing the bidding of music executives. They're artists, and they won't be tied down, you know. And I think American Idol conveys a completely kind of cracked idea of what, you know, artistry is about. It sort of takes the soul out of it. Now, if you complain about this, as I am, you just sound like the most tedious dentist in the world, you know, like, you know, sugar rots the teeth. But in part, that's what spurred the book, because for a while it seemed like that's all you would read about was like Clay Aiken, you know?
Ever since his hair got redone.
What's that?
When his hair got redone, it was a big deal.
Yeah, I know why. Well, I was just so confused. Like, I felt like, a stranger in a strange land. Well, I suddenly felt like an alien. I mean, like, we'd crossed it into this place where, like, it was no longer, it was now square, you know, to, like, Sonic Youth, and it was cool to, like, Clay Aiken. And I thought it was like a Twilight Zone episode.
I mean, I don't disagree with anything you have to say about American Idol, but I wonder if it just doesn't represent the fact that people long for, with 500 TV channels and 50 million things that you can look up on YouTube, people long for something that they know they can share, that is sort of a common reference point.
Yeah, that's probably it. I mean, and I suppose there's a lovely aspect to that, you know, that it brings people together. My parents are very disappointed in me because I won't play ball. You know, they're always calling me, "What, did you watch Idol last night?" "No, Mom, I didn't. I'm really sorry. I disappointed you again." But, you know, they want to have that Norman Rockwell conversation about who won and who was booted off the show last night. And, you know, I guess this is a typical Gen X reflex, but I won't do it.
Let's.
If they want to talk about the roots, I will. But
let's speak next to Austin in Dallas. Hi, Austin.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
Hi. My question doesn't necessarily pertain to Gen Xers, but I am 19. I was born in '88, and I love 90s music, 80s music, 70s music, any of it. And I don't relate. You talked about High School Musical, and obviously, like, I despise it just as much as either of you. But I'm not even a fan of American Idol either. So I guess my question is, where do I fall into place being 19 and not identifying with the newer stuff, but mostly the older stuff?
Come join us.
Yeah, exactly. You're one of us. Austin, you're one of us. Come. I think it's that's a fascinating point. I mean, this Gen X thing, Doug Copeland, who, you know, put the term out there in 91, at a certain point he said, look, it's really more of a sensibility we're talking about. Yes, it happens to flourish within this certain demographic, but I think you could find this X sensibility, which is really just more of an alternative sensibility among any age group, right? And I think that, in a way, if these generalizations are made about your generation, Austin, I think it's partly because we're waiting for your Nirvana. You know, we're waiting for your Pulp Fiction, your being John Malkovich. Where is it? You know, like, I would love to form a band, write a book. Like, I want to hear from you. You know what I mean? Because it seems like at this point, it's difficult to understand what the contributions to American culture are going to be from the millennials. And, like, what are they going to foist upon us? I hope it's strange. I hope it blasts my brain into a new place, but so far it hasn't happened. So that's why, you know, people associate your generation with things like High School Musical or, you know, Miley Cyrus or, you know, Paris Hilton or whatever, this kind of like pop trash culture that's out there, because that's what's out there.
Of course, you know, High School Musical was not made by high schoolers. It was written probably by baby boomers.
Yeah, probably Xers are to blame for that. You know, it's funny. Somebody asked me today, what are the millennials going to be angry at the Xers about? And I said, well, we created all those websites that you're going to waste your life on.
So, do you think, Jeff, are we really pessimists, or are we sort of secretly optimists who don't want to jinx things by articulating out loud what we hope for?
That's the most brilliant question I've heard.
Thanks.
I think we're secretly romantics. And romantics don't like to get their hearts broken. And that's, like, I think that a lot of Xers are secretly very romantic about Barack Obama, for instance, and yet don't want to admit it because they don't want to be burned. It's like we're like people who had some love affair 20 years ago, and since then we've been afraid, you know. because, look, the passion that you see in stuff like Smells Like Teen Spirit, you see in Nirvana's music and Liz Phair's music and Lauryn Hill's music and Lost in Translation, it's actually a romantic spirit.
Jeff Gordonier is editor-at-large of Details Magazine. His new book is called X Saves the World, How Generation X Got the Shaft but Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking. Jeff, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks, Chris. It was great. Thanks.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.